across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan
Show! It's coming up to Christmas. It's beginning to feel a lot like Christmas. I don't know the rest of the words. Monday the 16th of December, the Nolan Show from the BBC. We talk about traffic today. We talk about Christmas today. We have callers, as always, coming on, fighting with me, shouting at me, all in the mix, even at Christmas time, of a Nolan Show. Hope you enjoy today's programme. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning, everyone. Welcome along to another week of Nolan Show. So, what is Minister John O'Dowd going to announce today? He will make a statement today regarding the traffic chaos that is happening under his watch around Belfast. It's a big day for business as shoppers make plans for whether they will or will not venture into the city centre this weekend or not to shop. Remember what John O'Dowd's telling you. Get out of the car. Expect congestion if you're in the car and you're heading towards Belfast city centre. Get out of it. Get onto a bus. The only thing Minister O'Dowd won't tell you is how often he gets a bus when he's going into his office in the city centre. He says that he goes in about 1.5 days a week, so 1 to 2 days a week into his office, but he will not tell you if he gets the car every single time or not. There's this vague statement from the minister saying he gets public transport when he can. But it's an obvious question, and it is a fair question, given the fact that he's telling all of us to do it. How often, John, have you got the bus in the last, I don't know, let's take it the last quarter, the last 3 months? It doesn't just have to be when you're a minister. How often, minister, have you got the bus when you're jumping on to go in and buy a wee shirt or a wee pair of trousers or a suit? How often, minister, is what I think we would like to know. But if we come back to this announcement today, so what's he going to do? Is he going to double down and tell us this weekend? Because the RAC across the UK, they are predicting traffic chaos. They're talking about snarl up Saturday this weekend across the UK on the way. So here in Northern Ireland, given what we've experienced so far, would you go into the city centre or not? Businesses on tenterhooks about what the minister is going to say. On Friday on the Nolan Show, we heard from Sanjay Khanna from Mint Dry Cleaners that his business is in the centre of Belfast. Have a listen to the impact the chaos is having on his business.
Normally, it would take me around the 40-minute mark to do a certain stop within the hotel on Howard Street, Victoria Street, and Bedford Street. It took me an hour and a half the last time, to the point I'm thinking, this can't be sustainable, because I still then have to get back to work to process other orders for the same day or the following day. So it's really, you know, having to stay behind to catch up. Customers can't get in within time. I'm getting calls on a daily basis asking me if I could hang on a few more moments, maybe half an hour, to get in to pick up whatever they need or make some sort of arrangement that they get their goods. So not just myself, it's having an impact. It's like our customers coming into the city. And I'm probably speaking for a lot of, you know, businesses within the city centre. This is what we are faced with. All since they've closed, you know, these two or three streets, Victoria Street, you can't turn left from Howard Street, Grosvenor Road, there's no Boyne Bridge anymore. And it has a massive impact on the whole city centre.
Glenn Roberts from Retail NI with us today. Morning to you, Glenn.
Good morning, Stephen.
So you met the minister last week. What did you ask him to do?
Well, what we wanted to try and do is not maybe not focus on the problems, but focus on what are the solutions. We're just about a week, a critical week, because you know, if you're, a lot of shoppers are like me, do last minute stuff. So in support in that last week, we do everything we can to support the traders and get our consumers, get our shoppers in a timely, accessible and hassle-free way. So, I mean, amongst the things we talked about is Grosvenor Road, obviously, as your contributor said there.
The famous left turn where you can't turn left.
Yeah, the enforcement of the yellow boxes, turning restrictions along Great Victoria Street. I think there also needs to be much better communication and coordination. So the meeting today that we're a part of with colleagues in Belfast Chamber and the PSNI and the Council, and hopefully the Minister as well, we'll perhaps try and focus on what we can collectively do in these last sort of 7-8 critical days of Christmas shopping. And do you know what? I think we also need to get across that Belfast is open for business. I know the traders are working.
The minister himself, Glenn, has said if you're in the car, expect congestion.
Yeah. Well, what we've got to try, what we've always been advocating that people treat public transport as their first option rather than their last. It's about moving people. It's not about moving cars. We've been to the fore encouraging people to do that. What we need to focus on is what is achievable in these last 7-8 days. And that's what I hope today's meeting will focus on, is what we can achieve, because the traders are working exceptionally hard. Belfast has a fantastic retail and hospitality offer. You know, it's a real good experience. And what we now need to make it as easy as possible to get the customers, get the consumers into the city centre in a timely, accessible, and I hope a hassle-free way.
Is it not a bit late for this? So I'm not trying to be negative, but we had the head of roads, what do you call him? Chris Conway. It wasn't, that's Colm Woods. Thank you, Brendan. We had Colm telling us, well, look, we might consider working from home one day a week. And the reaction from the likes of the Chamber of Commerce to that, with Minister O'Dowd, he's refusing to tell us whether he gets public transport when he's going shopping. Can't tell us the last time, won't tell us the last time he got on a bus himself in his private or public role. So why should anybody else?
Well, all I can say from our side of things, along with Hospitality Ulster and Belfast Chamber, we've been flagging this stuff up since September, October. We call for the moratorium to be brought forward because people start their Christmas shopping earlier every year. Now, look, we are where we are, okay? It's not a good place where we should be, but we've got to try and make the best of these next 7-8 days. We've got to put all the stops and make sure that we can get consumers into the city centre in a timely way. And I think, you know, part of that is good communications, good coordination, and a solution-based approach. That's what we need to focus on today.
So, is the message get public transport? Because TransLink are also telling us you'll be travelling in bliss when you will not be travelling in bliss in some routes. You may in others, and we have had people tell us about how great it is to be on the trains, while we've had others telling us you're packed in like sardines. We've some people telling us about expand the bus lanes, and we've others telling us that the buses are stuck in the bus lanes. So what specifically are we being asked to do to help this week?
Well, as I said, we were walking through some of the issues. So Grosvenor Road has been highlighted, enforcement of the yellow boxes, turning restrictions along Great Victoria Street. There are probably some of the things. I don't think that the legislation, well, the Assembly's not meeting this week. So and even if it was, I'm not even sure that they would get the legislation to change the bus lanes in relation to use of taxis.
They're off for Christmas this week, Glenn, are they?
Well, all I'm saying is that the Assembly hasn't got any plenary sessions this week.
So I should have known that.
Yeah. But listen, we need to focus on what we can realistically do. And we need to get this message very, very strongly across, is that Belfast is open for business. It is a really good retail and hospitality offer this Christmas. And, you know, we need to encourage consumers to come in and to support those traders. Indeed, all of our high streets and town centres have got a good offer this year. But Belfast is different in the sense that its city centre is a regional economic driver, and it makes a big contribution to the Northern Ireland economy as a whole.
The recess date for the Northern Ireland Assembly, what is it? 14th of December to the 5th of January. My goodness, that's good holidays, isn't it?
Well,
next plenary sitting is the 13th of January.
Well, you have to ask the MLS why that is the case.
Well, I can't. If they're all, what are they doing? Sleeping or eating cocktail sausages? They might be out in their constituencies, of course. Who knows?
Well, I would assume that's what they're doing. And yes. I mean, there's important work that
very important.
But you know, but we need to focus on today, and we need to focus on getting what we can do. And it needs to be a collective effort right across, from the council, the business, to the PSNI, all of the key players, and obviously Translink as well.
Would it be too much to ask the PSNI, rather than just enforcement, and I get how important enforcement is with the yellow boxes and things, might we see any of them actually standing on the roads, on our streets, helping direct the traffic, helping to as you see in other major cities when there is traffic congestion, actually helping us with traffic at key junctions? Might they be able to do that rather than just threatening us with enforcement around the yellow boxes? I don't know. Let's see. Joe's in Warren Point. First call of the day. Morning, Joe.
Morning, Stephen. How are you?
I'm all right. I sailed into work this morning. Absolutely sailed. There was hardly anybody on the road.
Yeah, well, I had a bad experience yesterday. I drive into Belfast every other day. I was even in a Saturday, no issues. But I was down yesterday, come off the M1, up onto the Grosvenor Road. And there was about four or five cars ahead of me. And we missed the light six times. Not through any fault of the light system. It's the people that's blocking the junctions. Now, I think you said it yourself there a few minutes ago, the police should be out in these hot, because that tailback was back onto the motorway yesterday. More importantly, that was more dangerously. But I've watched drivers yesterday, even Translink's buses, coming across the onto the Grosvenor Road from, I don't know where I come from, the left. And he blocked the junction. Tailend was bus blocked the junction. Now I'm driving the bus myself. My lights are green. I sat at the junction till I had enough room to get back onto the Grosvenor Road.
It's a mess, you know, isn't it? It's a mess.
It is an absolute mess. But like I said,
but we've got to play our part in careful driving to help. Well, by the way, we are just hearing Glyn Roberts that Minister John O'Dowd will not be at these meetings today. As Derry's full, it'll be infrastructure officials, but the minister will not be at this meeting today.
That's news to me. I assumed that he would be, but we'll just have to do our best to focus on that meeting and get outcomes that can support city centre as best we can.
Sorry, Joe, you're blaming the motorists, aren't you?
Absolutely. I mean, look, there's nobody going anywhere. People block. Now, I come on to the Grosvenor Road yesterday. Now, I was going to Revolut with a crowd. And I decided
that's a credit card, is it not?
I thought so too, yes. But anyway, somewhere beside the City Hall, somewhere, I have no idea, didn't get to it. Right. I cut across at College Square and I dropped the people around to take you back onto that main motorway, you know, back, whatever it is, I don't even know the roads. But anyway, they were happy enough to get out there because there was not a chance of me getting near that place, I would safely say, for half an hour. Even that box junction, the taxis were sitting trying to get out to come back up the Grosvenor Road. They had every road blocked and they were coming out in the outside lane trying to get back into a single file at that junction that takes you left into College Square. You know, you can blame O'Dowd and Mallon before, and I think this dates back away back to Durkin. You know what I'm saying? There's not one individual.
They didn't. Sorry, there was none of this cancelling the left turn because some people were coming out of it of Grand Central.
Yes.
Obviously, the station wasn't there at the time, but they've cancelled the traffic turning left, and then they're saying they're reviewing it. Well, how long does it take them to review it? They say it's about the safety of the public. Why weren't the barriers put up? They're worried about people spilling onto the road from the footpath. Why were the barriers not put up from day one?
Totally agree, Stephen.
Why not?
Whoever passed the plan of permission for that train station, right, should have got the road long ago. First of all, it should have been complete disabled base by people for exit and entrance and the whole lot before that was even officially opened. That's opened halfway, midterm. It's not even complete.
Big day for business as we await this announcement from the Minister, Chris Souter, local businessman. Big week for you and the other traders, Chris, as people decide whether it's worth the hassle going into the city or not.
Yeah, no, Stephen, I think we need to make the point that it definitely is worth the hassle. The main issues with the traffic are always centred around peak time, so you're 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock in the morning, and then you're 5 o'clock, maybe half 4 to 6 o'clock at night is where the real pinch really is. So Belfast is very, very, very much open in between.
Look, I know that's the glossy brochure answer. I get it, and I get why you have to say that. But Belfast is a pain in the backside if you are trying to flow through that traffic at times, isn't it? Not all the time, not every day, but what type of traffic experience are we going to have this week?
Now, yeah, be honest. Stephen, to be fair, with this meeting that the industry's having with the, well, what I thought was with the minister, now you inform me it's not with the minister
today. No, the minister isn't going. He's too busy.
No, I mean, that's very disappointing. Very, very disappointing. But look, say let's be, we are where we are and there's nothing we can do about it. So fingers crossed that his representatives can speak on his behalf. For the next week, Stephen, I don't actually see what we can do apart from maybe offer free transport or a very heavily subsidised public transport system for the next week, possibly try that. Because we need to try something, Stephen, but I do think that people will come out in their droves this week shopping. We have seen a lot of support from a lot of disgruntled people, which has been great. Now, Stephen, as you know, with my business is a destination shop. We're going to get a lot of trade after Christmas. We've already had many of our customers over the last 32 years say, Chris, we're not coming in before Christmas. The traffic's a nightmare. We'll just come and see you after Christmas. But if you're a hospitality business and you have people cancelling those appointments pre-Christmas, you can't have your, as I said in Gamu this morning, you can't have your Thursday night dinner on Saturday morning. I really feel for the hospitality industry.
Well, why don't more people really just do what they're telling us to do? Get out of the car, get onto a bus or a train. Stephen, if enough of us do that.
Yes. You and I both know it doesn't work. The transport system still isn't fit for purpose. And there's a long-term strategic process needs to take place here over the next number of years. By the way, I was having these conversations with people as part of the bid like 10 years ago. And it's been a decade of lack of underfunding and a decade of in and out of storm and just impotency and nothing happens, Stephen. And we are now where we are. We're trying to force too much at once, and it just hasn't happened this year. And for what I'm trying to call for today with our industry buddies and the minister is that we at least learn lessons this year, Stephen, and that it doesn't happen next year. For me, this run up to Christmas has been a bit of a nightmare. I think this next week is going to be fine, but I think it could have been better. But for me, we have to learn lessons. We have to have more consultations. The business bodies have to be involved in governance of this city. And for this, for me, it's all about lessons now. Let's make sure this doesn't happen next year.
What is this meeting that's happening today? Who set it up? Who's organised it?
Well, Stephen, I don't know. Glyn will be able to fill you more in that because I think it's Glyn, Hospitality Officer, Belfast Chamber and the Department, the PSN. I'm not going. I'm not a member of any of those bodies. I just support them. So, Glyn, if you want to come in on that body and tell us what it's all about.
What it is obviously to find what we can do in these next sort of six, 7 days. So I would hope that there's going to be a clear strategy, clear announcements. And I think collectively we all need to be working together. One of the things that we need.
And you invited the minister, did you?
No, we were invited by Department of Infrastructure. I mean, obviously, it's worth pointing out we had a good hour with the minister last week. We walked through and talked through a number of ideas and solutions that we had. I know our colleagues in Belfast Chamber also had a meeting with him, and they were putting forward ideas. So
and was he receptive to them? Let's be fair to him, Glenn. Was he receptive to them?
I think he was absolutely receptive to them. So let's see what comes from today. Chris makes a very important point there. It is crucially important we learn the lessons of what has happened in the last few months. You know, I don't want to go back into the blame game again, but you're doing two major infrastructure projects, Sydenham Bypass and the Hub, at the same time in the run-up to Christmas was bad. That should
well,
never
have happened. They cancelled the work, didn't they?
Yeah, well, we had wanted, obviously, the moratorium brought forward a lot earlier because, you know, as I said, people do start the Christmas shopping earlier every year. But I think long-term, there's other issues. Look, why is Belfast so congested? 50% of the cars on the road are through traffic. Their final destination is not the city centre. And if we can address that, then, we will have this congestion dramatically reduced. We also need to properly fund public transport. We need to have it more accessible because we can't get people onto the buses and onto the trains if they are not properly resourced. Sustainable travel as well is another area we need to focus on. But what we're ensuring is that whatever way you want to travel into the city centre, you have affordable, accessible, and you have options there. Because there still is many people who come in from outside Belfast who do need to use the car. And if we can address that through traffic, then that's going to be a major step forward. So that's York Street Interchange. That's some of these other projects, big infrastructure projects that need to be brought forward.
All right, here's Colin and Port of Down. We'll say good morning to you, Glenn. Thanks for coming on today. Morning to you, Colin.
Stephen, not so much about the traffic congestion, but let's say I'm an American tourist with my wife or a husband and a couple of children, and I'm on the outskirts of Belfast in a hotel. And I ring up a taxi and I say, please take me into the new £330 or £40 million transport hub. The taxi can't do that because the new hub hasn't supplied an area for taxis to drop off and pick up. They drop you off, I think, maybe up to 200 yards or metres away from the railway station. But that's fine if you're able-bodied. But let's say you've got a crutch in one hand and a suitcase in the other hand. Fundamental mistake, they did not arrange for an area for taxis to drop off at the new hub.
Okay, there must be a drop-off. Why. There must be. I haven't been round to see this, but there must be a drop-off.
When you get that taxi guy from the Shankill or wherever he comes from to ring you, he'll tell you the truth about it. There is not.
Are they not sorting a drop-off with further work planned?
Well, they've been sorting it from the open station. How long does it take them to sort it?
Are you staying in or coming into Belfast this key shopping week?
Well, yeah, I plan to go up on Friday to St George's Market, but I'll get the train.
What are the trains like these days?
From Portadown, the hub of the north, they're excellent.
Good. Thank you, Colin. Joe in Warren Point. Morning, Joe.
I was on already down on the hole still. Look, Stephen.
Sorry, Joe, you've had a shout. Barry in Belfast. Morning, Barry.
Morning, Stephen. Just want to say, I sailed round that town yesterday, no problem. Like I do almost every Sunday. There's no bus lanes in Belfast on a Sunday. And the Joe public is so stupid, he just follows the driver in front, and they're all queued up around that town, bumper to bumper, bus lanes land empty. I stopped yesterday and spoke to a couple of guys at the back of the queue, maybe 100 cars in front of them, bus lanes empty, and as I'm about to drive up, stop beside him and say, you realise there's no bus lanes in Belfast? It's been on the signs for 40 years. And then they go, oh, is that right? And they follow me up the bus lane. You know, and it's the Omagh Road will
so
be
you're
the
a bus
today.
Driver, are you?
No, I'm a taxi driver, but I drive for Uber, so I'm not allowed in the bus lanes. But there's none on a Sunday. And the Omagh Road, every day of the week, Stephen, is only a bus lane into Belfast, 7:30, the 9:30
that's
in
right.
the morning.
That's right.
5 days a week.
That's right.
And all day, every day, they're bumper to bumper from the bridge to the city centre.
You're going to give away the secret. You're giving away the secret.
I know, but it's crazy.
No, it's great. Because all of those people that stay in that outside lane in the Armour Road at 10 o'clock and 11 o'clock and midday when it's not a bus lane anymore, and I just sailed down it, you've given it away.
Exactly, Stephen. The Joe public is so stupid. He's his own worst enemy. I have no sympathy for them.
You're an Uber driver. Why are you not providing a vital service if they're going to open up the lanes to taxis? Why shouldn't it include Uber?
Well, it should include Uber, you know, because it's going to take 200 or 300 cars out of the congestion. All taxis should be allowed in the bus lanes. It takes, you know, if they're all allowed in, it's going to take 500 or 600 cars out of the congestion and make life easier for everybody. But I mean, that's too much common sense for the minister.
Barry, thank you. Brian in Belfast. Morning, Brian.
Good morning, Stephen. Stephen, I've lived on the Falls Road all my life, and if you remember, or everybody remembers, we had about roughly 300 black taxis on the road in the early days. Unfortunately, you can count the black taxis on your hand now.
Really?
Correct. And if
why
you,
is that?
Well, I'll tell you why, because what I was going to say was, and how you're going to do it, is a proper, good bus transport service, because the glider helped to push, unfortunately.
Bliss.
You
can't talk
road.
About the glider without bliss. That's what they're telling you. You're travelling in bliss.
Well, all I'm saying is people started to use the glider more frequently and more. And the example is, unfortunately, it pushed the black taxis off the road, and it was over 300 black taxis on that road. That's a fact. So all I'm saying is a better transport service, and it'll make people get on. And
I didn't know the taxis were falling off.
Oh, God, I, Stephen, unfortunately.
I'll tell you a wee story about the black taxis. So when I was a young teenager, we're talking about 12, 13 years of age, I used to play snooker in the snooker club at the bottom of Westway Gardens, just off the Ballygamartin Road, just sits in the corner, this hut. I remember my dad dragging me out of it many times. So here's the story about the black taxis. So maybe a couple of years before that, maybe I was 9 or 10, and I would get the black taxis. And then as I ventured into my young teenage years, get the black taxis into the city centre, right?
Right.
So the guys in the snooker hall, a lot of them drove taxis, and they told me the special code word. This is a true story, right?
Yeah.
So they told me the special code word was service. So what happened was you get on a black taxi to top of the Ballygo, and when you got down into Lower North Street, you just said to the driver, service.
Yeah.
And you got the taxi free. So I thought this was incredible that I'd got this secret password. So on I get, I'll never forget this to this day. So on I get onto the taxi, and the 50p, because it used to be 50p.
Yeah. Okay.
The 50p for a taxi, of course, me being me, I had spent on sweets. So I'm sitting in the taxi, eating the crisps, eating the sweets, the 10p wham bars and all that kind of stuff. Right? Never forget this. And I get down in the Lower North Street and I said to the taxi driver, service. Wee squeaky voice that time, service. And this guy turned around to me, and this guy, his looks alone could kill you. And this big, kind of tattooed, burly guy says, what? And I said, service. And he said, pay up. What are you talking about? And of course, I had no money. So I got out and I did a runner. Right? I'll never forget it. Me running from this taxi. They'd conned me. They'd wound me up. And of course, I'd taken for... I'll never forget it to this day. Never. My wee fat legs running around along Royal Avenue. Service.
Pricked it. Right. Pricked it.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you, sir.
Okay, no problem.
Here comes the news at 9:32. The Stephen Nolan Show. Good morning. Israel has announced its embassy in Dublin will close after it accused the Irish government of extreme anti-Israel policies. And the Foreign Minister, Gideon Saar, said the Republic had crossed every red line. Mr. Saar said the actions and anti-Semitic rhetoric used by Ireland against Israel are rooted in the delegitimisation and demonisation of the Jewish state, along with double standards. The Taoiseach, Simon Harris, described the decision as regrettable, but rejected the criticism that Ireland was anti-Israel. Gabea Gaddis says, Cathy is a political correspondent with the Irish Independent. Do you want to tell me how I can pronounce your name correctly, and then I'll do it from now on, Gabea?
So, Gabea Gatavetsky. It's a difficult
Gabea,
one, I know.
Thank you. So, talk us through this.
Yes. So, Israel announced yesterday that it will close the embassy in Dublin. Now, I think the important context is that the ambassador for Israel to Dublin, Dana Ehrlich, she was recalled back in May. So she has not been in Dublin now for a number of months. She was recalled back to Israel when Ireland recognised the state of Palestine. But of course, the government in recent days decided that Ireland would join South Africa's case against Israel at the International Court of Justice in The Hague, which accuses Israel of genocide. And Israel has viewed this as basically crossing all red lines and saying the Irish government has extreme anti-Israel policies. And the foreign minister speaking yesterday, the Israeli foreign minister speaking yesterday, said that the embassy in Dublin would now be closed. This has been met with disappointment, as you say, from the Irish government. Taoiseach Simon Harris rejecting these claims that Ireland is anti-Israel. Taoiseach Micheál Martin, he said that the Irish embassy in Israel would remain open. There's no plans to close it. He's saying that Ireland and Israel will continue to maintain diplomatic relations, and inherent in that is the right to agree and disagree on fundamental points.
Well, maintain diplomatic relations, but they're certainly deteriorating, aren't they?
For sure. And this is the lowest point, I think, in Irish-Israeli relations. You know, recalling an ambassador is quite significant, but the closure of an embassy really means that the chain of communications between two countries is broken down drastically. I don't think at this stage Israel has carried out similar sanctions against the other countries that are involved in that case of the International Court of Justice in The Hague. Now, Ireland will keep its embassy open in Israel, so there is some line of communication there, but you can only imagine that the Irish ambassador there is facing difficulty herself in getting access to politicians, to diplomats, to do her usual work, and this will just make all that more difficult.
So where's this going to go next?
It's interesting, I suppose, because really Israel now has done, you know, has taken quite significant action. I mean, they could still expel the Irish ambassador that's in Israel. They haven't done that. The former Irish ambassador to the US, Dan Mulhall, said the closure of the embassy in Dublin is a bad day for diplomacy. He's saying the reduction in the level of contact between Israel and Ireland is not going to be a good thing for two countries like us. So there still are measures, I suppose, that Israel could take. But really, it is not a positive story for Ireland at all on the global stage, because, of course, Donald Trump is set to take office in the coming weeks. And this potentially could be seen as an attempt to embarrass Ireland on the global stage. Also, perhaps the ties between the new incoming Trump administration and the outgoing Biden one are not as strong as they were with the outgoing administration. And so it's being seen as an attempt to create difficulty for Ireland internationally.
Okay, Gabby, thank you very much indeed. Morning to you, 030 30 80 55 55. What about this story about the rubbish and recycling centres in Belfast under pressure from waste tourism? This is according to a council report which says people from other areas are travelling into the city to dispose of their waste. It's estimated it's costing the Belfast taxpayer $200,000 a year. Green Councillor Anthony Flynn. Morning to you, Anthony.
Morning, Stephen.
So people have got a bit of rubbish. They've nowhere to put it. They come into Belfast. They shop, they eat, they drink, they do whatever they do. What's wrong with that?
Yeah, thanks, Stephen. So I suppose the problem here is all of the different councils around Belfast, so all 11 councils essentially, work in silos when it comes to how they deal with their waste, both recycling and residual waste, which is essentially everything that goes to landfill. And the problem with that is we've seen in Belfast a massive increase in the amount of waste that's being presented at the household recycling centres. And that's actually led to a decrease in the recycling rate at those household recycling centres, while a massive increase in residual waste. And that costs ratepayers in Belfast almost £200,000 extra every single year now.
So what are you telling us to do with our dirt?
Well, essentially what we're trying to say here is we need to look at the positives across Belfast or across other council areas in terms of what they've done in recent years. So I know Ards and North Down, for example, they have introduced a new online booking system for residents in that area. So what we need to do in Belfast now is have a look at what they've done in Lisburn as well. Take the positives from that, take the negatives, and actually come up with a system that, you know, I'm not saying that we should do a online booking system as well, but what we need to do is have a look and see what they've done and the positives from that, and see, you know, can we do something that's better in Belfast and ensure that, you know, people can still recycle, they can still deal with their waste.
They can still what?
Belfast, they can still recycle, they can still deal with their waste, but, you know, Belfast ratepayers, I'm saying, shouldn't have to pay more to deal with other people's waste. We should be able to do this on an equal footing.
And but how can you possibly, like, are you, like, how would you sort this? Would you start IDing people and ask them for their postcode before they get into the recycle centre? Ask them for some type of address? Is that what you do to stop people using Belfast? Can you even legally do that?
Well, actually, they already do that in some council areas.
Oh, do they?
Ards and North Down, for example, they have an online booking system where you have to put in your details, your address details, and then I believe whenever you approach the recycling centre, you have to show a form of ID. And that's also in place in some other council areas as well. Stephen, but we don't have that type of system in Belfast. And, you know, I would argue, you know, previously that that's actually a good thing because, you know, I'm of the same opinion. Recycling should be as easy as possible, you know, for residents to do. But the problem that we've seen now, Stephen, is because other council areas have these systems in place, well, everyone else is just going to go to the easiest place to recycle or to bring their waste, and that tends to be Belfast right now. And that has led to an increase in, you know, the costs associated with that because Belfast ratepayers are having to pay a lot more to deal with waste that doesn't come from their council area. You know, but what I would say, Stephen, is we need to look at these systems. I'm not saying they're in any way good systems, but we can do it better, I think, you know, in Belfast. We can look at a better way of trying to ensure that the waste that we do collect is coming from, you know, Belfast residents. But, you know,
Are you being a bit mean?
Oh, no, I don't think so, Stephen. I think the problem here is
do Belfast people not travel to these other places and dump their dirt there?
Well, actually, you know, I think for residents, Stephen, really residents are going to go to the closest place to them, and that's absolutely fine. You know, what I'm saying is because we have councils that have worked in silos for such a long time when it comes to management of waste, it's led to the system where, you know, different council areas have different regimes, and it's very confusing for residents. And because we don't have an overarching, you know, strategy coming from Stormont to actually tell councils, right, this is how we're going to do it on a, you know, an equal basis across all 11 councils. So it's never really been that joined up thinking, yeah. Stephen, and it's led to this problem that we're seeing today where, well, why should Belfast residents have to pay more, you know, to deal with waste that doesn't come from the
and when you say pay more, why are they paying more?
Well, they're paying more, Stephen, through well, two scenarios, essentially. The first one is that there's been a massive increase in residual waste at the household recycling centres, you know, and that essentially means anything that's non-recyclable. Okay, that's being, you know, dumped into the non-recyclable box in the household recycling centres, and that means a lot more is going to landfill, and landfill taxes, Stephen, are going up every single year. Okay, and because there's a lot more tonnage going to landfill, ratepayers pay a lot more money to deal with that waste, and it's also just associated costs with, you know, management. So, you know, any time there's a skip that gets filled up in a household recycling centre, it needs to be replaced, and that has to happen more often now. So, there's costs associated with that as well, Stephen.
Okay, Anthony, thank you very much. Before you go this morning, has your party got any knowledge of what Minister O'Dowd's going to announce today? The traffic?
In relation to the traffic, Stephen, no, we don't. But I'm aware that the Minister has already announced in relation to Latin taxis and bus lanes and that type of nonsense, Stephen. I think that's a wrong approach when it comes to trying to tackle the problems with congestion in the city centre. I don't think putting, you know, thousands of private hire taxis into a bus lane is going to solve the situation.
So what's your idea?
At all. Well, actually, Stephen, what we've been arguing for such a long time is we need to invest a lot more heavily in public transport. And, you know, for myself, Stephen, you know, I tend to cycle around the city, and I've noticed a really massive increase, actually, in people trying to cycle in the city centre and sort of outside the city centre. I was just in Templemore just the other day, Stephen, and I, you know, every single bike rack in Templemore was being used on a Saturday morning. You know, that tells me there's a lot more people in our city who want to be able to cycle, but they don't have the infrastructure, the safe, segregated infrastructure that they do have, or they should have. So that's something that we would say to the Minister, actually, take the money that should be used for active travel and actually put it into active travel.
Well, let's see what he's going to announce today. Anthony Flynn, thank you. Next up are our MPs working too hard. The Modernisation Committee, which is chaired by the Leader of the House, Lucy Powell, is responsible for driving up standards. The committee has suggested more standard working hours for our hardworking MPs. But how hard do you think they work? 03030 80 55 55. The former Lib Dem MP and commentator Lembit Opwick speaking to us today, as is Shimeon Lee, researcher from the Taxpayers Alliance. I began by asking Shimeon what he thinks about this idea.
Well, I think that taxpayers will be very deeply disturbed by this development. I mean, MPs cost taxpayers a considerable sum, and taxpayers rightly expect that they actually show up for work. Just some figures, MP pay is £91,000, and if you multiply that by the nearly 600, the more than 600 MPs. That's nearly £60 million in total. And of course, MPs have just received a nearly £5,000 pay increase because their pay is, of course, linked to public sector pay, which received an above-inflation pay rise this year. And I think that if you just received a £5,000 pay increase, you come into work the next day and say you want to start working at 4 and leave at, start working at 10 and leave at 4, that really is a bit much.
Lambert?
It's not about working harder, it's about working smarter. And one of the problems I think we have now is a political class that doesn't really attract the best talent. And part of the reason for that is because the hours are absolutely abysmal. There's no doubt that I lost relationships because I was spending all my time working. I wouldn't be inclined to go back into Parliament, partly because it was just such a grind. I think we could probably get better politicians.
What's the grind?
You start, oftentimes, I was driving down to Parliament at 3 or 4 in the morning from Wales. I'd often be in Parliament, especially during the Northern Ireland peace process, till 1 or 2 in the morning. Now, I'm not sure you're going to get the best results from people if they're continuously exhausted and doing like 18 hours a day. Now, I have to tell you, not all the politicians do that. There are some lazy ones, but most of them are working quite hard. And I think it's off-putting. If you've got a family life, if you're trying to do something with your children, you might simply say, oh, I'm out of this. And I know that a lot of people left Parliament because they actually couldn't face the grind. Back to this point, let's get better results. And you could get better results by having a more civilised hours regime, because you'll get better people going in.
Don't you think, Lambert, those people who are standing on their feet all day, you know, hospital porters and nurses, those people are out digging roads, those lorry drivers that are driving, you know, pain in bottles because they can't get to a toilet and they're working round the clock and all of that, and they're maybe earning 30 grand a year, 40 grand a year, that they'll be physically sick at the thought of an MP telling them that they're working too hard.
Well, you can have that. I mean, we've had this conversation on your show many times, and you can make the comparison with some incredibly difficult and more difficult and less rewarding and worst paid jobs. But that's not really what we're discussing here. As far as I'm concerned, and I haven't got a vested interest in this because I'm not an MP, but as far as I'm concerned, there is something terribly wrong in Parliament now. The standard has dropped so much. The decisions are making are being made so much worse at the moment. And I think that's partly, in my opinion, because the job is so unattractive. The people who get into Parliament, the good ones, can actually earn a whole lot more money for fewer hours elsewhere. And I think that's one of the reasons why we're so badly served by politics. Now, that may seem counterintuitive, shorter hours for a better result, but I actually think that's where we are.
Shimin?
Well, I think if you look at the numbers, MPs are already doing less work. I mean, just compare them to previous years. So in 2023-24, the House sat on just 101 days. That's less than half the number of days they sat in the previous financial year, and actually the lowest number of days they sat in the last 4 years. Now, if MPs think there's not enough, you know, work to fill the time, maybe the problem is that there are too many MPs, there are too many roles to fill. I mean, we have 50% more MPs than the US Congress has congressmen. We have double the number of MPs than the Canadian Parliament. You have 4 times the number of MPs than the Australian Parliament. So maybe the problem is there's simply too many MPs.
No, well, that doesn't even make any sense because on the one side, you're saying that we need to have more hours from MPs. Now you're saying we should have fewer MPs. That's completely contradictory. But you're also ignoring the fact that most of the most important work is actually done in constituencies. Now, I don't think the suggestion is that MPs stop doing their constituency work. All that stuff about being online means that you could be in your constituency and still have meetings. Most other companies do that. I do most of my work online now for meetings, and that saves a huge amount of time and wasted effort in terms of travel. So if the MP responsibly does the work, which is really local, fixing the potholes and sorting out the local problems, then this could be a force multiplier for the thing that people really do notice, which is having their MP on the ground in their area instead of sitting on the motorway going to and from Parliament.
Shimon, what What don't you like about us trying to make MPs more comfortable so that they can attract the very best people into those lawmaking jobs?
Well, it's not about making MPs more comfortable or less comfortable. It's about making sure that MPs are paid according to the work they do. We absolutely understand that.
It's also about making the job attractive, isn't it? So that we get the very best we can.
Well, I mean, I think that the fact that you have so many people who actually want to be MPs shows that it's an extremely attractive job. And in fact, there are many accommodations for MPs. So, for example, on the point of having to work in a constituency, MPs actually get an allowance to have a second home in London because of the difficulties of doing the job. MPs also get different hours than people, so they start a bit later and they end a bit later as well. So there are many accommodations to make the job attractive for MPs. And I just say again that the fact that you have so many people who actually want to be an MP shows that it is an extremely attractive job.
It's not, I have to say, I think, this, as I said before, the standard of our politics has never been so bad. And I think that's because we're not attracting the best people into Parliament. You say the money is high, and it is. 91 grand should be pretty attractive. But the job, and I've done it, I did it for 13 years, the job is intensely corrosive to your family life, to your state of mind. I was just continuously exhausted whenever I was an MP, and probably it meant I didn't do my best sometimes. My feeling is very simple on this. You're mixing up the idea of being in Westminster as being the most important part of the job. And if my interpretation is correct here, they're saying the formal part should be more time limited. I have to tell you, I would agree with the Taxpayers Alliance if the idea is that an MP just works at 10 till 4, including the casework. That would be completely unacceptable. But if it means you don't get pinned down in Westminster when you've got people crying out for help in their constituencies, as is happening a lot all over the country at the moment, then I would say this actually means you've got more time to do the important stuff and a little bit of a rein in on the stuff that often doesn't make much difference. The late Frank Dobson once said to me, 20% of everything we do in politics is virtually pointless, but the other 80% is pointless. And I think it was a little bit like that in Parliament, but not so much in the constituency.
Final word to you, Shamin.
Well, on the point that MPs have a very hard job and it actually takes a toll on their social relationships, I think that's true of many jobs, not just being an MP in the private sector. I mean, if you look at top executives in major companies, they're working many, many, many hours a week. That takes a toll on their family life as well. But unfortunately, that's just the fact of the matter. It's a difficult job. It's a difficult job being an executive in a top company. It's a difficult job deciding on the laws of the nation. And MPs know this when they go into the job. It's a sacrifice, but that's what the job is all about.
Okay. Shimeon and Lembit, thank you very much. Thanks for talking
to
us. So do you reckon our politicians are need a bit of a bit of TLC? Maybe work a little less hard? 030-30-80-55-55. Ken's in Ballyclare. Morning, Ken.
First time caller.
Are you?
Listened to you for a long, long time.
Why have you never called before?
Because I've never had so strong an opinion to be able to call you and to waste your time on the radio.
Fair enough.
The dumping situation, the use of getting rid of your stuff at dumps. The local dump to ourselves is Bruffley, Antrim and Newton Abbey. And I turned up there a couple of weeks ago, and said to the guys, right, I've just got a car full of cardboard. And he said, have you booked? And I said, no. Last 3 months, Ken, I'm really sorry.
I would sort it out for after 10, but your phone's breaking up, and I know you're a first time caller, so we'll see if we can get you back after 10 this morning. Jason Coleraine. Morning, Jason.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Go ahead, sir.
Why did it take John O'Dowd, the minister who was responsible for so long, to make a statement about it?
Well,
the traffic situation. I was up in Belfast all the week, and it was chaotic. So it was.
Why didn't you get the bus?
Well, you can't get buses when they're being cancelled all the time.
No, it's bliss.
So as last week, TransLink cancelled our bus from Corrien to Londonderry at the very last minute for the parade.
Jason, are you sure you're not mistaken? Because you can't, obviously they're not talking about every bus, but TransLink are pumping out ads at the minute telling you this.
Go by bus, train or glider and embrace the bliss of a hassle-free commute with TransLink.
Bliss.
TransLink and Corian cancelled buses at the very last minute. They could not get out of Corian at all on Saturday week. Past.
Well, was that the bad weather? Was that the storm?
Yes, but there were TransLink buses in Londonderry. Were able to get up from everywhere else. So how come if they said it was they do with insurance? Does TransLink have different insurance? Does the minister know? Is there one insurance company for one area or one insurance company for every other area? Can the minister, who took ages to respond to anything he's been asked, he knows it's going into recess now, so they all forgot about by the time they come back.
I'm not sure it'll be forgotten about. I really, just with the amount of public reaction that there's been to the traffic situation, I'm not sure, Jason, it's going to be forgotten about. You're not excited that the minister might actually announce something today that might help alleviate the chaos?
Well, he might, and he might not, but he knows he doesn't have to answer any questions for the next couple of weeks anyway.
Well, we'll keep on asking them. Do you know what we need, Jason? We need to also soothe ourselves. We haven't played on the Nolan Show our first Christmas song yet. And it's, where are we? The 16th of December? I think we need to calm down. Just take big, deep breaths and give each other a hug. And here's my favourite Christmas song.
Come, they told me, ba-rum-ba-bum-bum. A newborn king to see, ba-rum-ba-bum-bum. Our finest gifts we bring, ba-rum-ba-bum, rum-ba-bum-bum, rum-ba-bum-bum. On this earth, can it be? And years from now, perhaps we'll see. Our finest gifts we bring, of glory. Live in peace away. So peace on earth when we come. Every child must be made aware. Every child must be made.
You see, I think we should reach out to all the politicians who you all torture all year and give them a big Christmas hug. And enjoy this music all together.
I pray my wish will come true. It's for my child and your child too.
Bum bum ba dum bum.
You'll see my day of glory.
We love you, Gavin. We love you, Michelle. Happy Christmas, Naomi. Mike and Claire, a Christmas hug for you too. I'd never hug you, Jim Alistair. Never.
Can it be?
Bum, bum, ba, dum, bum. Here's the news at 10. There I was on Saturday night with the mini eggs and the prawn cocktail with Big Audrey, watching Strictly Come Down. It was fantastic on Saturday night, wasn't it? And the winner was crowned. Comedian Chris McCausland made history becoming the first blind contestant to win the series and lift the glitter ball trophy.
I don't know what to say. I honestly thought I could go out in the first week or two, and And I know no one went out in the first week, but I thought I still could. We've just lasted and lasted. This is for her, and it's for everyone out there that just got told they couldn't do something or thought they couldn't do it, and it just shows with opportunity and support and just determination, just anything can happen, you know?
Well, Chris's win was cheered on by Jason Smith. Jason is visually impaired, a Paralympic winner. Good morning to you, Jason.
Good morning. How are you?
And winner of this year's RTE, Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah, feels a distant memory at this stage.
I need to put one of those aerials up to get the RTE. One of those aerials on the roof. So, look, Jason, a lot of talk here about Chris, clearly, and it prompting conversation about the how we look upon people who are blind and how they look upon themselves. So what's been your experience? You've been visually impaired from the age of 9.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's been fabulous really it's about building awareness and attention to the matter, isn't it? Because one of the challenges I find, and I know the wider vision impaired blind community find, is it's somewhat of an invisible disability, and therefore often people don't see and aren't as aware of the challenges. And I think, you know, what these kind of opportunities, mainstream TV, again, I know some from myself on an Irish perspective, winning Dancing with the Stars, it just sheds a light on it and it opens up the conversation for people to become more aware of it.
What happened to you when you were a little boy then?
So I was diagnosed with an eye condition called Stargardt's. It's a genetic eye condition, roughly the central part of, well, to explain it, the central part of my eye is blind. I've roughly about 5 to 10% vision. And as you can imagine, it impacts.
In both eyes?
In both eyes, yeah.
So what do you see when you look out? Do you see shapes and colours or not, or what?
Yeah, as I say, the centre part of my eye would be completely blind. So it's not black, it's not white, it's just the centre part as if it's nearly invisible. It's just the object there doesn't exist. Then my peripheral vision, what I would pick up things is often because of the colour contrast. So if I see in the, 5 metres away the tree and I see green and I see brown, you're making out the objects depending on often where the colour changes, but I wouldn't see, like you could be standing a metre away from me and I wouldn't see your eyes or if you're looking at me or your facial details. I would often then rely on you to say hello to me, that then I would identify who it is speaking to me.
And when you were growing up as a teenager then, so diagnosed age 9, happened age 9, were those teenage years tough?
They were, and I think it's the wider challenge, and I'll probably open it up beyond just blind and visually impaired. I think it's one of the questions you had mentioned initially, but that the kind of wider space with people with a disability. For me, it did a lot in terms of denting my confidence, my belief in what I felt I could do. I spent a lot of those years trying to hide my lack of vision because often you're trying to fit in and want to fit in and want to be seen as whatever you perceive normal to be. And I think, there's that, some of the society's perceptions is one of the things Chris said there that I really like, society's perceptions. So when you think of somebody who can't see, what do you automatically think? You think of the things they can't do rather than the things that they can do. And those kind of society perceptions also impact people with visual impairments, people who are blind, that then what they think they can do. And it's moments like that. It was one of the things I found for me in my sporting career was always trying to do is those moments, those platforms, is to try change people's perceptions of what you think someone can do.
But
it doesn't matter what you
give
can or
stuff.
Can't see.
Like, I've got the age now, I don't care what people think. Why care about what other people think? Why not do it for yourself?
And maybe that's a piece, you know, you said there, you know, where I'm at now, I don't care what people think, but is that something everybody feels all the way through their life? And again, I reflect on...
Oh, no, it comes with age, doesn't it?
Yeah, experience. Yeah. And I would say that myself. I look back as a teenager and think, why did I care to the same extent as I do now? So, but often those younger years, isn't it? That's where you're growing, learning more about yourself. So I think absolutely time and perspective, you can have that view. But it's easy in hindsight sometimes to look back.
You can let me know what you all think this morning, 030-30-80-55-55, about Chris McCausland's win. I'm presuming, Jason, that one of the big things, I was talking to someone on Five Live about this last night, actually, is that you don't want to be treated any differently. You don't want to be treated with sympathy or some type of false empathy because mm-hmm. of your disability. You want to be treated the same as everyone else, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So in that context... So I'm watching Strictly on Saturday night. Chris McCausland cannot dance anywhere close to as good as some of the other dancers, and yet he won. So was it unfair on the other contestants that you had someone that was not as good a dancer, but part of why he won was because of the amazing bravery, the amazing stamina, the amazing personality, charisma that he had as an individual? But he wasn't the best dancer at all.
Yeah. And I would say that was the same situation when I won the Irish Dancing with the Stars earlier this year. There was better dancers than me in the final. But the competition doesn't say who is the best dancer. The competition...
That's what it's supposed to be, is it not?
Is it? I mean, it's a reality TV show and it's about connecting with people and somebody that you get behind... enjoy their story, I don't know, see their challenges, something you resonate with somebody that then you vote for them. So I don't know, I'm not, I don't see it as having to be the best dancer. I think what we're always wanting to is connect with people and their stories. And I think that's the powerful piece and the powerful message.
Maliki's called us this morning. Morning, Maliki.
How you doing, Stephen?
Go ahead.
I have to agree with you. I would be a Strictly fan, but like all these competitions now, unless you have some sort of, same as X Factor, unless you have a dead budgie or a dead parrot or a granny who'd passed away and a sad story to go with your singing voice, you're never going to get on TV. A girl used to work for me. She'd done X Factor, but she had no sad story, so she went nowhere. And Strictly Come Dancing, the girl Tasha, who has a hearing problem, was absolutely out of this world. So good was that girl at dancing that the judges even said she was the best Strictly Come Dancing celebrity they ever had on the television. And because Chris McCausland, don't get me wrong, the guy is visually impaired and it's a problem for him, but he was absolutely rubbish at dancing. He shouldn't have been in the final. It was a complete sympathy vote. And for people to turn around and say they have to be treated the same as everyone else, that's fair comment. But in this case, he won that competition simply because of his visually impaired problem. Nothing to do with dancing.
Well, you're describing it as a problem. Maybe he won that competition through sheer admiration for, like, how difficult. Well, Jason, you can tell us, how difficult is it to dance when you can't see the floor? How difficult is it to do all of those moves with your partner when you can't see your partner?
Well, it certainly is extremely difficult, and you only have to imagine yourself. Close your eyes and try walking down the street.
I can't dance with my eyes open.
Exactly. So never mind having the will to go on national TV and not have any dancing and then doing it with your eyes closed. That is admirable, isn't it?
I understand that, Chris, but the problem is, was it
Maliki,
a good result?
Maliki, yes. It's Jason on with
us. Sorry, Jason, I beg your pardon.
Sorry.
Jason, I watched Jason actually do the Irish one, and he was fantastic. And, you know, he was good at dancing. But McCausland, to me, definitely wasn't. And you have to think for that girl, Tasha, how must she feel that she lost? Why did she lose? Answer me that, because these competitions now, you had the judges, which I think is more so of a joke, who were all telling everyone how brilliant Chris was at dancing. And, you know, he was brilliant. And he wasn't. So all them judges are celebrities. And they cannot or don't say anything bad against him because of the absolute support he has from the general public. And therefore, they're saying he's great, he's brilliant, he's super. And he's not. So the judges and the competition, which you rightly said, it's called Strictly Come Dancing. It's supposed to be for the best dancing. And if you were an ordinary person going in there and you danced your way into the final and you'd done all the training, and then because a guy who is visually impaired wins it hands down, he would be absolutely gutted. I certainly would be.
Malachy, thank you. Good morning to you. Jason, how much... I was speaking to someone who was blind last night on Five Live, and they told me that they would never go back. If they had to choose again, they would never want to see. And I could not understand that. Do you harbour a dream that one day there will be any type of medical advancement that you will be able to see again?
It's funny that you even mentioned that, because I kind of resonate with that myself and what that person said. That being said, I love the ability to see normally. I'll maybe explain both of those. When I look back, and I used to always think not being able to see and have limited vision was a weakness, and it has been a challenge. But now, but when I reflect back, all the opportunities I've had because I can't see, I feel like has made me and developed me into a person that I would never have become because of the challenges I've had to overcome. And it's in the overcoming the challenges that we grow and develop and improve. And I think there's a positive piece around that.
If you lose one of those senses, does your sense of smell, does your sense of touch enhance?
So I would say, and maybe everybody's different, my hearing would be better. And I think it's in everything. You have to learn to adapt in a different way. So there's never one right answer, but it's your other senses or something else has to become heightened. Well, I find it does to nearly try fill that gap somewhat. So for me, absolutely, my hearing would be just maybe a greater awareness, because I have to rely on that more than my sight.
And then I was mentioning Dancing with the Stars at the RTE, which you won. Reese McLennan's doing it next, is he?
Seen that this week. I was actually a bit surprised myself to see him. I don't know if he got what major championship he might have next year, European Worlds. But yeah, it'll be a thing for me, as it was a huge commitment. That's probably the one thing you don't see watching from or sitting on the sofa. The commitment around it is massive, but I think it'll be great to see how Reese gets on. And I assume with his gymnastics background, I think of rhythmic, surely he's got to be a reasonable dancer.
No, I think that man will have two left feet. Let's see. Let's see. I'm telling you, there's just something, because he's so brilliant at what he does. Let's just see what type of a dancer he is. Let's see. From someone that I can't coordinate anything, Jason. I really can't.
Well, and I'm not. I came from zero background in dancing, but yes. I think as time, with the right attitude, it took me to week 7 or week 8 before I felt like I started really accelerating and improving. So there's hope for you yet.
Thank you very much. Look, lovely to talk to you this morning. Thank you. Happy Christmas, Jason.
Same to yourself.
We can say that now. My goodness. Monday the 16th. I'm off from Friday. You've only got another 5 days of me. And that's me off until end of January. I'm getting nearly as long off as the politicians. Brian. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning.
Right. Well, your holidays are pretty good for the Dosh you're on. That's for sure.
Ah, wind your neck in and be nice at Christmas, for goodness sake.
You see, if you hadn't done your usual cutting me off, however,
don't
I was
you
about
ring
to
me?
Say,
don't you ring me most days of the week? All your eyes guff.
I was about to say to you, but I don't work a 6.5-plus day a week. So that
7 days a week I work.
Well, you take time off to feed yourself, and I'll allow you half a day off.
Right? I do.
So you cut me off, and I was about to give you an inadvertent compliment there.
Yes.
Look, it's a difficult one, isn't it? You have a guy, I mean, I have great eyesight, so there I'm on the back foot already. But competitions like this, why doesn't the likes of the BBC get together and have a version of Strictly, which is for people that were physically and visually impaired and so forth, as opposed to this? I do believe there was a sympathy vote there, in a sense. And
what do you want to carve off disabled people and have their own competition rather than everybody competing together? Really?
Well, we have an
Why
Olympics.
Would you do that?
We have a version of the Olympics like that. So I don't see the issue. I think it would be fabulous because it would. I'll tell you why I think it's a good idea, because it would widen the chance for people to get on television and show that they can work with their disabilities and have had great achievements in living with
but
them.
But showing it by competing with and against people who do not have a disability, is that not better? At the end of the day, you know, you can't say this was stitched up because it was the audience decided. It was the British public decided that Chris was the winner.
What you're sort of getting at here from the start of the show is, was it fair for Chris to win because was there a sympathy vote there? So I'm giving you my opinion, which is that fair play to him, but I think it was, you know, probably sympathy vote towards his disability, which you've touched on. So therefore, I think it would be great, as we have in the Olympics, a separate Olympics. We shouldn't be strictly for people with disabilities, and it would broaden the amount of people from that background that could get on television. Why not? It's not something that should be shunned.
Brian, thank you very much. Good morning to you, sir. And a happy Christmas to you too. 03030 80 55 55. I don't know, I'm definitely, it's just, I woke up this morning and I thought it's definitely time to get into the Christmas spirit. Now, there's a wee story knocking around that for those of you who go to your friend's house or your relative's house for a Christmas dinner, should you be putting your hand in your pocket and actually putting down a deposit to your friends to help with the food costs and things? Belfast Telegraph Night editor John Laverty with us this morning. Morning to you, John.
Morning, Stephen.
There was a poll, Money Supermarket Household Money Index, revealed that 42% of people in Belfast agreed that they should be contributing to the turkey and the Brussels sprouts and the gravy if they go to a mate's house and get a Christmas dinner. Commentator Emma Wolfe. Hello, Emma.
Good morning, Stephen.
Don't you spoil my Christmas spirit this morning now. Be gentle and lovely and Christmassy.
Always.
What do you think, Emma? Should people be handing over money when they walk into someone? The editor of this programme, Ross, he's worth a fortune. He would take it. He just doesn't invite us for Christmas dinner.
Do you know what? I actually think it's a really good idea. Christmas is such an expensive time. And if you're going to have, it's bad enough having 10, 20 of your relatives round on Christmas Day. Factor in the price of the heating, the price of lighting, the price of all of the basics just to have 20 people tramping through your living room all Christmas Day. I actually think the Christmas dinner itself, the price of potatoes has gone up, the price of sprouts has gone up, the price of turkey, the price of every fuel, everything has gone up. Butter, everything, mince pies, chocolate, the price of chocolate's doubled, nearly doubled in the last year. I actually think, in the spirit of Christmas, everyone should contribute. We're going to my big sister's, and we will definitely, I'll probably take the veggies, Mum will probably cook the turkey.
Oh, for goodness
I think
sake.
Everybody should contribute. It is a big job. You prepare for 10 people, 15
of
your...
You want me to run around with Brussels sprouts in my boot?
In the back of my bike. No, this is what I'm saying.
No.
People, it is a big job hosting the family for 10, 15 people on Christmas Day, and I think, why not contribute? Whether that's financial or everybody takes part of the dinner.
John?
Well, Stephen, I have a house, not a restaurant. This is not a restaurant business. This is, as you mentioned earlier, the spirit of Christmas.
Yes.
This is This is inviting your friends and your family, people who have done things for you all through the year. This is your way of saying thank you. I say it's not a restaurant. It's a time for giving and not for taking. Now, any time I've gone to a Christmas dinner recently, either if I've been the host or the guest, we bring things anyway. I mean, the last time our house held a Christmas dinner, the amount of stuff that was brought in, the amount of bottles of wine and things like that, they would keep me going for months. And I just think it ruins the whole spirit of Christmas to be expecting people to charging people. Because this is about friends and families. This is about favours.
Who sets the price?
Another thing, by the way, it was on our own news bulletin there. Turkey and sprouts have actually got cheaper, so it wouldn't be £20 a head for us. It would be more like 15 if we ever got that far. But I don't. If you want to all contribute, go to a restaurant, but not somebody's house.
Hang on a minute. I cannot see how it ruins the spirit of Christmas. For everybody to turn up, whether that's everybody popping 20 quid in a kitty or whether it's actually everybody brings part of the dinner, it's a big, big job having everybody around. I wouldn't wish it on anyone. I've never hosted the family for Christmas dinner and I wouldn't want to, but I'm very, very grateful if anyone else wants to have all that hassle. Getting up at 6 in the morning, starting baking and getting everything, cooking and getting everything ready.
It's once a year, Emma. Once a year.
Yeah, of course. But why does it ruin the spirit of Christmas in any way? Christmas is meant to be. It's not meant to be about presents and Amazon vouchers and, endless, endless consumerism. It's meant to be coming together with loved ones and sharing. And that is what this is. Everybody contributing.
They're your friends and relatives. They're not restaurant guests.
You're not presenting. Come on, John. You're not presenting them with a bill at the end of the meal. I'm not. You're not dressing up in a waiter's. Well, I hope you're not dressing up in a waiter's outfit. I'm just saying, if everybody shares
brings
the burden and the cost, what's wrong with that?
Everybody brings something these days. They bring desserts. They bring wine. Everybody contributes, but money-wise, it's very, very vulgar to bring money.
I genuinely don't. Am I bad at this?
Yeah, you are.
If I'm going to visit someone at Christmas, I don't bring anything with me.
You just turn up.
Oh, no, Stephen, you have to bring something.
Do you?
With your appetite.
No, I don't. I really don't. I'm not organised enough to bring anything for myself, never mind them.
A bottle of wine, Stephen, you've got to bring at least that.
Well, then you've got to get into what type of wine. I don't understand wine.
Nobody cares what type it is. It's just a token gesture, to say thank you for being invited.
Stephen, you're not short of a bob or two. How about you turn up with a big thing of chocolate, a couple of bottles of wine, some pre-prepared Christmas food, mince pies. Come on, get your finger out.
I was bought an advent calendar. I got it at the start of December. It's gone. We haven't. you open the wee windows for the chocolates. They're gone.
You try convincing a four-year-old not to eat all of the chocolates on the 1st of December.
I know. Isn't Christmas just a lovely time anyway? Isn't it? I love Christmas.
I can't believe you turn up empty-handed.
Do you know what I want to find? And I don't know where selling them. I was driving past the other day and I saw these deer and the animals that are all lit up in the bright, in the lights that are in people's gardens now. Where do you get those?
God.
I love
dreadful.
Them.
Dreadful. Dreadful.
They're giant big things
absolutely
that sit in the
appalling.
Garden. Massive.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I want them for my house.
Absolute eyesore.
Well, I want to try to find some. I like all that type of stuff. Listen, happy Christmas, Emma. Happy Christmas, John.
Happy Christmas to yourself.
Happy Christmas, Stephen.
Say happy Christmas, everyone. You know I love you, don't you? I'm starting to sound like Hugo as every day goes on. Happy Christmas, and we'll see you all tomorrow for more Nolan at 9. Have a good day.
To fly.
And so I'm offering this simple phrase to kids from 1 to 92. Although it's been said many times, many ways, Merry Christmas,
Merry Christmas.
Thank you.